Welcome to the Future of Love teleseries presented by the Integral Spiritual Experience, Integral Life, and iEvolve Global Practice Community. The Future of Love dialogues continue this week with Gangaji and Eli Jackson Bear with Dr. Mark Gaffney. Gangaji is an American author, speaker, and gifted spiritual teacher. Eli Jackson Bear is an author and spiritual teacher at the Leela Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to world peace and freedom through universal self-realization. Dr. Mark Gaffney is a widely recognized world spirituality teacher and author, and the co-founder of iEvolve Global Practice Community. In their dialogue, Gangaji, Eli, and Mark will talk about enlightenment from an integral perspective. What is enlightenment? What is its relationship to love? And is there a genuine connection between the classic realization of enlightenment and the way one lives an authentic relationship? It is with much pleasure we present Gangaji and Eli Jackson Bear with Dr. Mark Gaffney.
Hello, Eli. Hello, Gangaji. Welcome.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Hello.
So glad to be here.
It's so good to have you. You guys must be exhausted. You've just flown back from teaching in Europe.
Right.
And we are 3 months.
Oh, my God. I actually heard we were in Europe at the same time. I was teaching with my partner in this series at an iEvolve with Diane Hamilton. We were teaching in Germany, and so we had some people who were with us that had just been with you, and particularly in this particular case, Eli, there was one person there who told us how you changed his life when he took, when he read From Fixation to Freedom, your book. It was a man who lived in Dortmund and now has a spiritual center in Dortmund and was just singing your praises, and we were so delighted.
Oh, thank you, Mark. That's really sweet to hear.
Yeah, that was completely lovely, completely lovely. Well, thank you, everyone, for being with us on the call. This must be our 12th, 13th, 14th call in the Future of Love series, and we started with our mutual friend Ken Wilber, and we've had a lot of mutual friends of all three of ours on the call, from, you know, Joan Borisenko to Marilyn Schlitz, you know, our friend from Eons, to Deepak Chopra, to, you know, from his perspective, Gabriel Cousins talking about love from the perspective of raw food, and of course Roger Walsh and Francis Vahan. We just had a wonderful, wonderful group of people, and we've all been just really excited and looking forward to this call with you because there's so much to talk about. But I just want to begin, before I frame the first question, I want to begin just with love, with just to share with everyone on the call. There's like 10,000 people signed up for the series, and you know, quite a few hundred of you on the call right now. Just to first off, to love you and thank you for being with us. You know, and your energy holds the space here. One of the great things we know in the mystical traditions from my lineage master, and I guess Eli Gangaji terms, we would call him my Satguru, right? My Satguru from a different generation, the Baal Shem Tov, right, is that we receive more from those who listen than we're ever able to give them, and the way they hold space and hold presence. And that's just been so true in this series. So thank you to everyone. And particularly thank you to Eli and Gangaji. And I just want to say, in public with great delight, Eli and Gangaji and I met several years ago at a particular crossroads in life. And it's one of those conversations when you're really on the inside of space, you remember things forever because you're on the inside. You know, at your house, Eli and Gangaji, and a beautiful conversation we have. And I think we took a walk that night. I remember it very, very clearly. And, you know, Eli and I have had occasion to be in touch and, you know, in all sorts of ways, talking, been together in some particular places. And, you know, Gangaji, just I've always just received, you know, your love and friendship. And I just love you both very, very much. And what better way to start a future of love? Yeah.
Thank you, Mark. We love you, too. Really.
Yeah.
It was so beautiful when you showed up in Arkansas during my chemo treatment. That was really beautiful, too.
Yeah.
Expression of your love.
I just to say to everybody in a funny way, as we start with for Eli's chemo treatment, I was the most inefficient person in the entire world. Poor Eli, you know, at the end of 5 days, poor Eli said, God, you know, like, I love this Rabbi Baal Shem Tov guy, but man, when you're trying to do chemo treatment, he can't find the keys to the car. we had a really beautiful time of realization, you know, in the midst of it all. So loving you both, and here we go. So, Eli and Gangaji, you're both, you know, teachers. And I don't want to put any labels on what anybody teaches because that's, you know, that's of course inappropriate. But one might say that you're non-dual teachers. Is that a fair way to say it? Teachers of the ultimate non-duality.
You might say that, yeah.
That's a fair thing to say. Okay, you know, and some people call it, please. some people would call it direct. So, go ahead, please.
Oh, it's a good starting point, I would say.
Yeah, it's a good starting point. You know, direct path, you know, the kind of ultimate oneness, right, that lies, you know, in the depth of all reality and which defines all that is. Now, our series, right, is on, you know, the future of love. And my job, and you always have to know your job, my job here is to both share with you some of what we're thinking, but mostly it's to really, you know, hear from you what you're thinking about the particular sets of conversations we've had. So there's kind of a through line in all of our conversations. You don't have to have listened to the series, but I'm participating, so I'll share that with you. So let me begin with a kind of very obvious and excited question, you know, which is, when we're all one, right, if all, everything, you know, at the end, right, is one at its core, which is the realization of just what reality is, whether it's from the Zohar, whether it's through your thought gurus and teachers, whether it's through your own realization, whether it's through my own, you know, internal understanding, right? When everything is one, well, what do we do with two? Right? If there's not a personal self in the kind of American personality sense, which where all love conversation takes place in much of the literature, well, then what's a relationship? You know, my partner, my life partner, Mariana Kaplan, who sends you both warm regards, and I've actually shared with her, you've never met, but I've shared with her quite a bit about you and how much I love you, that she did a play called Zen Boyfriends. And Stas, who was the lyricist, wrote something like, you know, we are one, we're not two, but there's still me and you. The distance is breaking my heart. So how does, just to open up the field to this conversation, and you also have warm regards, although you haven't met yet, but we all know each other through Sally Kempton, Durgananda. And Durgananda just described to me as, you know, we spoke, you know, a week ago before the call about a couple that was going to her retreat, right, and was going to a non-dual satsang, beautiful retreat. And, you know, Sally's retreat was really a heart, awakened heart, Kashmir Shaivist retreat. And the non-dual retreat, you know, the person came back with this realization that, oh, my God, there's no me. And so he says to his girlfriend, oh, my God, there's no me, there's just consciousness. And she breaks down crying and says, I don't want you to be consciousness. You know, I want you. So how do we play? And you spend so much time, both of you, right, really teaching this and living it as a couple. I mean, you've actually lived it. You haven't just taught it. So talk to us about this great, you know, I've opened up a big field of conversation, which could take us the whole call, but this will at least begin, and then we'll kind of dialogue and talk as we go. Is that a fair place, Eli and Gangaji, to start?
Yeah, yeah. Sure. Let's start with Gangaji.
Okay, Gangaji. It's huge, you know, but when I hear what you're saying, it seems to me that most people make the assumption that there's some difference between consciousness and love, and there's some difference between you and me and consciousness. And so from my perspective, it, I mean, as I said, you could say we invite people to experience non-duality, but that doesn't exclude separation. I mean, it's literally non-dual, which means all duality is present.
So when you say if there's one, where's two? Two is included. I mean, if it's totality, totality includes one, two, and three. So people have this concept that oneness means an absence. People get stuck in a sense that because it's one, there's no distinction. But all distinction shows up in oneness. There's infinite distinction and infinite possibilities of one, two, three, up to infinity, all included in oneness. And so it's not that you suddenly become one and then you lose everything else. Everything's included. One includes total. And so there's no distinction between if there's two, where can oneness be, or how can you have two with one?
It's there's no distinction, and there's finally, in a very deep sense, a recognition that you are in relationship with yourself as all. I mean, to me, it's the ultimate tantric relationship. You and the universe are lover and beloved, met as oneself. And That, of course, can sound pretty abstract, but experientially, it's both very mundane and very profound. They're both included. So I know we as a couple live an ordinary life. We have our ups and downs. We have our moments of bliss and ecstasy. We have our arguments. We have our disagreements. But it's all recognized as this great play, this great lila of self or God or consciousness, whatever name we use.
And so this person who comes back from the retreat and says, oh, I realize there's no self. Well, who is it that realizes that except the individual self? So that's included as well. So there's the personal self appears within the field of totality. It's not separate.
Yeah, no, completely received and completely beautiful. And I think, you know, it was just wonderful to hear how you say it, you know, and we all say things through the prism of our unique selves. The Baal Shem Tov would say it in his particular way, but just to hear you saying it out of your realization and out of your couplehood, that is delightful. And for everyone listening, you know, this is one of the reasons we really, besides, you know, my utter love for them, you know, but besides that, just their deep realization, just to hear Eli and Gangashi talk about, right, this notion that actually non-duality means everything's there. And so therefore, although the personality doesn't become a reified absolute reality, of course, it plays a non-duality, because I think the best way to say what you've both said so beautifully is that if relationship was not part of non-duality, it would be duality. It would have excluded.
Exactly.
That's
oh my
the
God.
Point.
Yes. Oh, my God, oh, my God.
Point.
So, so from that place, that actually brings us to the second question to really open up the conversation, which is, so what does a recognition, right? And again, you know, my job here is really, really just to be in this delightful place of I'm listening for everybody, you know, for all the hundreds of people on the call. Just to listen with such delight to share with us what, from the perspective of teachers, and I want to ask you later, perspective of a couple, what does the recognition of the absolute bring to relationship? Why is the recognition of the absolute so important in relationship? What's missing when it's not there? What does it add in such a dramatic way?
Wow, that's a very complex question, you know, because in one very real sense, it doesn't necessarily add anything. I know people can have excellent relationships and have no notion of absolute or any inclination to that. And also people can have had the most profound realizations and have no interest in relationship or not be even good at it.
And people can have profound realizations and have terrible relationships. And so, and yet, we know people. And yet, we also know people who, through their realization, it transformed their relationship. Because once you stop taking it personally, once you realize the truth of your own being, you can love your partner as they are without trying to project onto them or fix them or manipulate them or control them in order to get something for yourself. Because once you're already fulfilled, then true relationship actually is possible. Before you're fulfilled, you're always looking to the other to give you some sort of fulfillment, to make you happy, to do something for you, to give you what you need. But once you're fulfilled, you can love them as they are without having to change them or fix them or get something from them. And that's where the real possibility of true relationship is.
I think it's really, if we're talking about this, we have to think about the different kinds of relationship. Like I know people who are in long-term marriages who have relatively formal relationships. I wouldn't call them deeply intimate, but it works mm-hmm. for them. But
it
what
works.
Interest? Yeah, it works. But what? And I would say they're relatively happy. But what Eli and I, and what I was so thrilled about Eli when I first met him over 30 years ago, is that he really wanted intimacy, freedom, and intimacy, and how do those two come together? And it seems to me the only way they can ultimately come together is if you are, as he said, coming from fulfillment, and then the intimacy is limitless. But that's our interest. First of all, it was truth and freedom, but always with that was an intimate life, a life that's lived fully and deeply and sometimes quite messily.
So let's feel into that. So first off, I appreciate your, you know, recognition, both, you know, both Gangaji, you and Eli, both Eli, just where you kind of prefaced your answer by saying, you know, with an enormous amount of humility that, of course, we all know couples who are, you know, limited to personality, but for whatever reason, they work it out in some very, very beautiful and deep way, right? And we know, of course, you know, non-dual couples who have completely not worked it out yet. But what we're looking for is really what can the recognition of the absolute recognition, what can it, in the best scenario, in a fabric, right, of culture and arising, what can it give to us? And what we're hearing is that it kind of, and tell me if I'm reflecting back, and I know it's only a small piece of what you said, and I want to kind of pick up on that strand, is that in some sense it takes the grasping out of relationship, right? And it takes the, right? You know, so that in some sense, because, please?
Because if you aren't grasping, then you can surrender more deeply, and that ties back into intimacy, because intimacy is ultimately about surrender in all ways.
So intimacy, so you can let go of the grasping, there's a kind of surrender, right? And intimacy is about surrender in all ways, and that the surrender to, so finish the sentence for me, help me out, so the surrender to the ultimate realization of what is, once that surrender has been accomplished, then that surrender, I mean, of course, never accomplished, it's always accomplishing, but once that surrender is in play, once you can feel it, taste it, touch it, right, in some real way, then when you bring that, right, to relationship, so then you're actually playing out that surrender again and again, right, in the realm of the world, but actually the non-dual playing in the world, something like that.
Well, yes, and to me, the key word here is surrender to the unknown, because of whether, you know, we may name it enlightenment or God or whatever, but as long as we know it, it's still a concept in our head, and we are then in control of it. But when we surrender to the unknown and we recognize that this word enlightenment or this name of my partner is only the beginning of the conversation, that there are worlds, there's depth that is unknown and is limitless, it seems to me. And that's what I'm pointing to.
And also I would say that the surrender is a surrender to truth. And that truth, that when we got together, it was a commitment to truth more than to relationship. And that's really what deepened us and set us free. And then at one stage where I had an affair and lied about it, the horror of the lie was really devastating to all of us. And it again taught me the nightmare that comes when we're not dedicated to truth. So that at that point, I was putting relationship above truth, and it didn't work for us anyway. For us, truth was put above relationship, and out of that, then our relationship flowered. And so when you, and so the truth is always unknown, and that's what Gangaji is saying. And so when we're willing to uncover what we haven't seen, then that brings up whatever is needed to deal with. But even deeper than letting go of grasping, I would say that when you're fulfilled, you do let go of grasping, but also there's an enormous capacity of love that doesn't need anything in return. And this is something that then nourishes everyone. It nourishes yourself, the partner, the relationship, the world.
Yeah, well, fantastic. I mean, completely, completely gorgeous. Letting go of grasping, right, a surrender to the unknown, letting go of the kind of the conceptual frames, right, and then even deeper, right, a surrender to truth, or even deeper, another face of it, a surrender to truth in which truth lives beyond the relationship. The relationship doesn't become idolatrous. It's kind of like we've killed all the gods except for Aphrodite, and the only god that we actually remain is Aphrodite, and then we worship at our altar, and truth actually can't find her way in because she's subservient. And then you know, you both add on, and Eli, you add it particularly at the end, but it's actually more than all that, that when you actually surrender into the field of unknowing, which is all that is, actually what pours through you, but is a kind of spacious love, right, a kind of freedom, right, and power in the most sacred sense of the term, that then infuses the relationship. You're no longer loving from your small self personality, but you're loving, right, as part of the seamless code of the universe, which is, of course, seamless but not featureless. It's uniquely happening through you. And so what a delightful, right, and gorgeous picture that you're painting for us, right? So thank you. Thank you, a deep bow. And a question, a deep bow and a question. So my teacher, who was both my teacher of Talmud back in the day, right, and really one of the people who mediated the Baal Shem Tov to me, his name was Joseph Soloveitchik, a great, great, great master in a particular lineage school. And he used to say, and I wanted just to share with you and get your resonance on it, he used to say that if you look deeply into each other's eyes, that that's where you start a relationship. You know, ultimately, you're going to get it lost in each other's eyes, and as beautiful as it is, you're not sure where you're going to come out. But if you first look deeply towards the horizon together, right, towards the which Eli perhaps truth is that horizon. And then from that place, we then look deeply into each other's eyes. Right? So then everything shifts. But does that resonate with you, that teaching? Does that feel like
it's beautiful. It seems that it's very grounding. That, you know, it's the difference in narcissus and true self-love. It's not exclusive. I believe that's what I'm hearing you say when you speak of that. It's an inclusive love. So you actually start with the horizon, the known universe, and what's beyond, and then you turn to each other and find that in each other. But I know that this whole notion of falling in love, whether we, you know, whether it's Aphrodite or Narcissus, can be one that just is implosive rather than explosive. And when we're willing to, I believe Eli really said it, whether relationship is subservient to something greater, whether you call it truth or agape or whatever your name for universal love is, then to me that's the horizon. So I bow to your teacher. How beautifully he knew that.
And thank you for deepening his teaching, Gangaji. You know, and that's how that's how we meet. That's how masters meet. So from that place, you know, it might be fair to say, and I want to kind of frame this provocatively for both of you, but it might be fair to say that we get in trouble when we marry for love. And we might actually say that actually we shouldn't marry for love. Meaning, of course, you know, in that provocative formulation, not that you shouldn't have love in marriage. That's a fantastic idea. But that when we look to marriage, like that relationship, like that's the place we get love from. That becomes our exclusive fountain of love. Then the marriage can actually never meet that, because the love that you're describing from your own realizations and teaching is so much vaster that there's no way that a particular one relationship can ever feed that all. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yes. You know, our wedding vows, when we did our wedding in a cave in Haleakala on Maui, our wedding vows were that as long as the relationship serves truth and freedom and awakening, then we're in relationship. But the truth and freedom and awakening is what we were really serving. And if the relationship serves that, it was beautiful. If it doesn't, then the relationship's over.
Also, I think that points to what Eli was saying earlier about if you're looking for fulfillment in another, so you become infatuated biochemically or romantically with another, and then you, of course, project that other will give me my fulfillment, because there's an experience of fulfillment only. It doesn't last, of course, and marriage lasts. True marriage really, really does last, but it can only last when you find a source of fulfillment, not in the form. The form is included, as you were just saying, Mark, and is a reflection of that, but it's not the source of that. It's a spark in that.
So, Mark, also I'd make a distinction between falling in love and being in love, because the biochemical process of falling in love is genetically wired so that we will reproduce, so that we'll have babies. And what it does is it automatically, once you fall in love, the biochemical process sets off brain chemistry so that we only see what we want to see, and we don't see the other. We really see a projection. And that lasts for a certain period of time. Actually, it lasts, ideally, for the species, it lasts long enough so that you bond and have babies, so that by the time you wake up from it, it's too late. But really, the true love doesn't change and doesn't come and go. It's the projection that happens with the falling in love that is not reliable. Because eventually,
it doesn't make a marriage.
It doesn't make a marriage, because eventually you've projected a screen on the idealized other, and then someone else shows up behind that screen. And that's not who is there when you start.
Oh, my God, who is that?
I know. Eli always said he had one good year with
God.
Me, the first year.
That's right. That first year was great.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. That's hilarious. I mean, that, and it's, and we all recognize it. It's so true. Like, you know, when you're in the falling in love stage, you know, you say to the other person, hey, honey, would you like to go see a movie? The other person says, you know, sure, honey, I'd love to see a movie. What movie would you like to see? As long as we're together, it's fine. right? And then it's a couple of years later, right? And you say, honey, would you like to go see a movie? I can't believe you're asking me to see a movie. That's a violation of my integrity. Shows you're a patriarchal, and oh, my God. What happened? Well, that really brings us.
It's like the bowerbirds. Yeah. There's a kind of bird in New Guinea, the bowerbird,
yeah,
where the males all set up in an arena, and each one builds an art project. They do these incredible things. They collect different colored berries and different colored stones, and they make these beautiful art exhibits. And then the females come along and look at them, and they pick the best art exhibit, and that's the one that they mate with. But the male never does another art exhibit. You know, it's like she thought she married an artist.
That's hilarious. That is hilarious. Oh my God, I thought you were an art exhibit, and I see. Oh my God, that's fantastic. Just another bird, right? Another bird who, as you've both said so beautifully, who in the end, when we go, and there's kind of level one, art exhibit, level two, just another bird, and as you've said so beautifully, when we actually really experience the true perception of love, I realize, wow, you really are an art exhibit, but in a completely different way, including
that's
so
right.
much more than I ever thought it was.
Yeah, more than I could know. Yeah, more than I could
know. Unknowability. Yeah, back to Gangaji's unknowability. So from the place of unknowability, so I wanna shift the conversation to the realm of the personal, just because you have so much to teach us, both from your teaching and your realization and from incarnation, right? That is to say, you know, you've lived for quite a while together. You've known each other, as you said, for over 30 years. I mean, wow. I mean, I mean, wow. You know, like that. That. And you've been actually in a couple for how long?
Since 1976.
Wow. So that's more than a year or two, I would say, if my math is right.
it's
34 years.
Yeah.
34 years. Wow. I mean, that's a lifetime by itself. And just from that place, you know, in 34 years, you know, in the Hebrew tradition, when you look at the sacred scripture and you look at the description of Moses, you know, Moses who's this great, enlightened, realized master, you know, and the scripture, of course, presents him in all of his complexity, because there's no reason that great, enlightened, realized masters aren't complex, because we're all complex, and no one, you know, from Ramana to Moses, no one escapes that. So I'm sure you've had your complexity over the years, and yet, you know, you've really made it through. Like, here you are, loving each other, dancing on this phone call, exhausted after the trip from Europe, you know, somehow schlepping on the call to talk to our friend Gaffney, and just delightedly dancing together and, you know, deferring to each other in a very, you know, natural way, and kind of talking not into each other's sentences, but complimenting each other's sentences. So it's not even by what you would tell us about your relationship. We can actually feel it, you know, right here, you know, on the phone call in front of us, that great Hindu word lila and that great dance. Right? You're actually dancing, you know, for us, you know, right now and here. So I can't resist but to ask, just to share with us, you know, over the years, from any particular part of your life, you know, there must have been great moments and hard moments, as you said earlier, Gangaji. And not to talk about any particular, you know, great or hard moment, you know, unless it comes up, but more, you know, what have you learned? You know, what do you know, not only as teachers of the non-dual path, but as this, you know, Eli and Gangaji, these two unique selves that never were, you know, are or will be ever in history again, you know, enlightenment shining through your particular unique perspectives, because enlightenment always has a perspective, but it can't be otherwise. Emptiness is form, the form is emptiness. What do you have to share with us, right? And not that you're claiming that you do, but we know that you do, which is why we invited you on this call. Right? What do you have to teach to us? Not that you're saying, but we would like you to teach us, that you've learned as a couple over these 34 years. Oh, my God, how delightful it would be for all of us to hear that.
Yeah. You know, well, when Eli was speaking, he said what was primary for us was truth, but really, initially, that was not so for me. What was primary for me was I fell in love, infatuated biochemically. I fell in love with this being that was so huge to me and thrilling that someone like him actually existed, that was willing to not only meet me, but take me places I had never been. And so I was interested more in that than truth, quite honestly. And it was only Eli's love of truth that I caught. I caught the love of truth. Maybe first, just pragmatically, I recognized that in order to be with this man, I had to share some of his interest. And his interest was, I think we called it at that time in the Confucian way, living a righteous life. And so that's how I began. He was my teacher. He was my spiritual teacher and my mentor. And I was just so shocked at this force of love, because he didn't fit any of my images of what I thought I wanted as a partner or as a mate or marriage. And I was looking for another marriage at that time. I'm 5 years older than Eli, and I had gone through one marriage, and I had been played a lot in the early 70s, and I was burned out with kind of promiscuity of the era, and I wanted a committed relationship, but Eli wasn't interested in that at all. And so initially, and many times in our partnership, this was a huge crisis. And there was just this such a force of love that I had to surrender. I had to surrender my ideas of what he should be like, what our partnership should be like. And I would do meditations, you know, really just seeking clarity. Is this abusive to myself to be in this relationship with this man who it was clear didn't love me as much as I loved him and didn't want what I wanted? But there was just something that was so deep and so profound that I was benefiting from, that I did surrender. And I would say that's how our relationship started. And then it took many turns from that, where we would actually switch roles, where I would be the teacher for a while, and he would have to surrender his notions, and he did have to surrender his notions of what an open relationship meant. And so we became monogamous, and then in these last few years, we had another major crisis, you know, where he had this affair, this very private and then public affair, and we split up. After 30 years of marriage, we dissolved our relationship. We said we've gone as far as we can go together, and it was very essential that we cut each other free. And it was something I was afraid of, but in the moment of it happening, it was liberating. It was thrilling. I didn't have the burden of this relationship and my trying, you know, to even surrender to anyone else. I was just free. And then this force of love that was there at the beginning, it reasserted itself and actually commanded us to be back together. So I would say that's the short version of the story of love.
Wow! What a love story! What a love story! And Eli, please just share with us, just from your perspective, in any way you'd like, just so we can kind of, I mean, just Gangaji, in the way that you shared it, and the beauty of it, and the depth. I am 1,000% sure, not 1,000, a billion percent sure, that, you know, there's X amount of couples right now listening right now who just got such inspiration from the nuance, the depth, right, and the refusal to surrender to anything but the highest place, not to surrender to the concept, not to surrender to what it should be, to what people think it should be, right, to kind of really defy all of the small self-insistences, right, to really hold out for what the larger field of possibility is asking. And as you said too beautifully, I want to pick up on that word, commanding. I mean, what a great word. I just want to, before we turn to you, Eli, which we're so excited to hear, I just want to kind of pick up on that word for a second. You know, commanding. You know, it's a word that, you know, kind of got lost, because it got lost in old religious structures when we felt commanded by things that actually weren't aligned with, that weren't congruent with the deepest sense of who we are. But you're talking about commanding at a whole other level of consciousness, where actually you experience a command. You actually experience obligation. And that's so powerful for me and for all of us to hear, to begin to reclaim the idea of command, not at a mythic, you know, level of consciousness, which is kind of something external violates me and commands me, and I'm forced, right? But actually, I'm compelled in the highest sense, right? I'm commanded. This is in this incarnation, this is my man. We're together, and the depth of our love, right, ends all the trances, and brings us back together, you know, after we've gone through all these iterations. I mean, there's just The only way a person can respond to such a description is just to say thank you for sharing it, just with great, great delight and beauty. So thank you, Gangaji.
Oh, you're
thank
welcome.
Thank you. Rev. Eli, the most delightful, wonderful one, who I'm so delighted to have as a friend. Share with us just how this, you met 34 years ago. You've been together 34 years. Just your experience from any particular time or place, whatever comes up for you, of course.
What I would say, Mark, is that love is trustworthy, and that when we first met, I had no interest in relationship. I had no interest in love. I've been living as a solitary traveler, a spiritual pilgrim. I've been searching for a number of years for my final teacher, and I wasn't interested in children. I wasn't interested in family. I didn't want to be dragged down by relationship. And I was, relatively inexperienced in the whole scene because I had lived celibate for a while and I had been on my search and not in relationship. And so I was really a baby in a lot of ways and not interested in settling down. And so it took us 13 years to get married. And before we did that, as Gangaji said, she started out as my student and I had to fall at her feet and kiss her feet and say, this is the energy of the Satguru. And when I said that, when I said, this is the energy of the Satguru, and I bow to you, I surrender to you, she said, what is Satguru? So fresh, so pure, Mm-hmm. And I'd say that some of us are wired for monogamy and others aren't, and I knew from the very beginning I was not wired for monogamy. I wasn't interested in monogamy. And that was one of the real issues of our life that we had to deal with. And that's why it took us 13 years of living together before I finally surrendered and kissed her feet and we got married. So we got married 13 years after we were living together. And so monogamy was something I've had to learn, and I've made mistakes along the way. It's not something that is organic to my being, but it's something I've had to surrender. And it's a surrender to love. It's really a recognition that love is in command and that my own personal desires or my personal searchings and cravings were really secondary to what love commands, and that it took a certain discipline and something that I, have not been perfect with, but committed to. And so in that, Gangaji became a great teacher for me. And in that, I saw the possibility of a deeper, more intimate relationship than I ever wanted or desired, but found the depth of that to be so valuable in my capacity to see within myself and to serve others. And until I saw this within myself, I really couldn't help others with it, because you can't take anyone further than you've gone yourself. And so my own personal limitations were really blinded to them until Gangaji revealed them through this commitment that we had, so that in the commitment there's a fire so that everything can come up and be revealed, and you can see yourself. You can see your imperfections. You can see your flaws of character. And that's been one of the great gifts that I've received in this pure love that she taught me and I caught from her. And I mean, I always loved her. I always deeply, deeply loved her. When I met her, I said, you're the clearest, the manifestation of light I've ever seen. And I wrote poems to her. But this is a different level of love, that she took me to. And I'm so eternally grateful for it.
Thank you so much, Eli. Thank you so much. You said so many beautiful things. It's hard to know where to start. When I say beautiful, by the way, I want to kind of define the word. I don't mean beautiful in the sense of lovely, right? I hate lovely. I don't mean beautiful in the sense of, saccharine. I mean beautiful in the sense of the good, the true, and the beautiful. The beautiful, that the beauty that has both goodness and truth in it, and therefore its beauty kind of shines. So I want to just pick up, on one phrase, which was so great. You said, I kind of caught it from Gangaji. I think that was the phrase you used. And it's this kind of sense you're describing. It's such a beautiful phrase, right? You kind of, and how do you catch something, right? It doesn't happen in a moment. And it doesn't happen in a conversation. I mean, what you're describing is not, we sat down and worked this out in a therapeutic context, although who knows, that this can always be very helpful context at different times. But you're talking about this catching, right, of something, this catching where you kind of catch this wave over, right, a lifetime of really deciding that we're actually going to stay and do the work. And that something happens, and And you can actually hear in both of you, both you, Eli, Reb Eli, and Reb Gangaji, you can actually hear your own evolution that you've actually caught from each other. You've kind of caught your own kind of, you know, and it's so clear that although you both would have been delightful individually, but that this actually is this large karmic union. What we might have talked about in the old Kabbalistic school as, you know, sharing a common soul root where you each do a great tikkun, right, a great healing, transformation, fixing, evolution, to translate that Aramaic term, just by the fact of being together. So I'm kind of feeling that sense of the great karma of your union and the great gift that it gives to me in this phone call and to everyone who's been with you, because you've really been willing, you know, to stay and do the work. And it feels like, and this is, I want to raise a question here, right? And I'm actually discerning in my mind heart now, because there's so many ways to go, what's most valuable for everyone, and trying to distinguish between that and what I want to talk about, right? Which is, let me try and make that discernment here, right? It feels like certain couples have the privilege, and it's a privilege I'm sure that, you know, we can each pass on. Like, we can say, like, hello, we'll pass on that privilege. You know, but yet it is a privilege to actually do the work in some sense for the collective. That when you become a public couple, even though you don't really want to be, kind of, you're actually forced by reality to actually work it out, not just for yourself, but you're kind of working it out for everybody. Right? Because, and people need to see how you work it out. I've been, in the karma of my life, you know, dealt with any number of these issues. And when we talk in a different context, I would talk about that, but I don't want to get off track. So I want to ask about one particular issue that's come up a couple of times. You know, the whole issue of monogamy, right, and love out of the context of monogamy. Because that's a big issue for our listeners who are all, you know, living in a conventional and then at the same time a post-conventional context. Many, many people in this phone call are in classical monogamous marriages. Other people are on this call, I know, I see from the webcast questions that are coming in, are afraid to enter, right, a monogamous marriage because they're afraid that their love will die in that context. You know, it'll shrivel. You know, one person just wrote in and said, you know, Eli and Gangaji, all my friends who are married no longer have true romance. All the ones who aren't, you know, do, I'm afraid to get married. Right? So there's that, you know, there's that feeling. So just, you know, and of course you guys met in the mid-70s when the open marriage book was the book. It was a different cultural context than today. You know, so just, if you can just share with us just each your reflections, you know, either personally or as teachers, you know, how would you advise people? You know, a young couple, a young man, a young woman comes to you. You know, let me start with you because we just spoke to Eli. A young woman comes to you, right, and she says, I'm madly in love with this guy, you know, and he tells me he totally loves me, right, you know, but he's not willing to make a monogamous commitment. What do I do? I mean, what do you tell that young woman today?
Well, I certainly don't tell people what to do, for one thing. Really, I would say it is essential that we all recognize that there's no particular formula that's right, but that's what we discover in the intimate relationship. And you know, I mean, a question I might ask her is, what do you want? What do you finally truly want? And it may be she has to walk away from the relationship, and it may be she can surrender to that. You know, you mentioned several things, and then quoting from someone who wrote in about losing the romance, we found that, you know, Eli said we married 13 years after we had been living together, but about 4 years after living together, we started to get married. And within a month, we were treating each other like we treated our first husband and his first wife. We fell into a pattern. And so really the challenge here is to be free, of course, and to not formulate that freedom. And yet, and this is the razor's edge, of course, is to tell the truth. What is serving? And for me, it was ultimately so serving to be in an open relationship and to have to deal with my jealousy. I also was having other lovers too and was enjoying that, but to deal with my extreme jealousy, to have to face it, to have to meet it, was very useful. And then it wasn't useful anymore. It became just a repetitive pattern, and I saw that I was not willing for our relationship to always be about the relationship. And at that point, then, it was clear that monogamy had to come in. But that's just Eli and me and the particular path we were on. And as you said, it started in the 70s, and that was a whole different worldview. It's a messy business, discovering what's the right thing for a partnership when two people want different things.
I just want to add one little postscript to that, and that is that we've had such beautiful, deep romance in the last few years. I mean, you know, we've gone through periods where our work was primary, and we were even traveling in different circuits and didn't see each other for a few years as much. But lately, I mean, we've had, you know, profound romance. And so it's not something that we search for. It really depends on what you want. If what you're searching for is romance, well, that's one thing, and you'll get that. But that romance for us came as a byproduct, I would say. And that's something that's returned in such a sweet way that's quite beautiful.
So Eli, let me, so thank you. And that was a really kind of a, you know, sharing into the space of Gangaji's, you know, Gangaji, of your beautiful response. So Eli, let me pose the question to you, the same question I posed to Gangaji, but this time, of course, it's a young man, right, who's coming to seek your counsel, right, and saying, hey, you know, I'm a big lover, I'm a seeker, you know, there's this woman who I just completely adore, but just, I'm just not hardwired for monogamy. I know that I'm going to hurt her, and I can't make a false promise. Should I enter the relationship, or shouldn't I? You know, what he's now in front of you. How do you guide him?
I don't. I guide him. Stay true. Stay true to your heart, you know. You have to stay true to your heart. And if you stay true to your heart in the deepest sense, love is the teacher and love is the master. And love shows you the way. So you might make a mistake, but if you make a mistake, it'll be from your heart. And then you'll learn, and it'll be a test of love. I'd say that all of life is a test of love. And really, the choices we make, if they're based in anything but love, then those will be the consequences. If they're based in love, then whether they're the right choice or the wrong choice, love will be in command, and love will teach us the lesson of it, and we'll deepen and learn from it. If it's based in anything else, it's going to be something that comes and goes. Love is solid and real and is here. And so if you're basing your choice in love and in something that's real, then the consequences of it have to be positive, regardless of the outcome. It may not be what you expect, but it will be based in love. If it's based in anything else, it's going to be based in, you know, egoic fantasies, and they lead where they lead. And that will also be a test of love, and it will also show you and hopefully wake you up to see what's real.
Thank you. And so let me just to feel into that and to thank you for the answer. And on behalf of everyone listening, you know, I'm sure there's many, many people listening who this is really up for in a real way. So we're not having an abstract conversation in the ivory tower of the academy, but we're in the midst of a kind of swirling Leela, you know, the Shakti, you know, dancing, you know, in front of us and with us. So let me pick up on two things here for our next set of questions. You know, love is a teacher. Love is a master, Eli, and you talk about that so beautifully. And one of the things that comes up in Gangaji, you have this, you know, wonderful phrase that, you know, goes together with Eli's love as a teacher, which is, we were talking about open marriage and monogamy. You said, you know, at one point, you know, working with the jealousy, it was so useful, and then it wasn't useful anymore. Mm-hmm. Right? And you know, there's like, oh, but then it wasn't useful anymore. And I think what we're hearing, if I can try and extract just some of the pearls, right, that you're sharing, I think that what we're hearing here is a deep willingness to be open to the unfolding and to the unknown. Right? That actually, if you try and superimpose a category, right, then at least if you're at a particular level of consciousness, it's actually not going to work. And you have to be willing to say, right, that what worked yesterday doesn't work today. And in some sense, that's what we mean when we talk about moment-to-moment awareness. That's exactly what it is. That in some sense, just reflecting out loud with you, right, that in some sense the conventional, right, the conventional structures, right, of relationship that are so wonderful, and I want to really emphasize that to everyone listening, and so valuable, And I would say, you know, when my students would come and ask me, what should we do about, you know, different relationship structures, almost everyone I would say, go the traditional way. Because I think for most people, right, in the world today, the traditional structures with all of their problems, you know, still offer an enormous safety and enormous guidance. But if for whatever reason the traditional structures are insufficient, right, and you want to actually, you may want to wind up married, you know, in a monogamous relationship for your whole life, but you actually have to get there through your own deep evolution and openness to the unknown, you have to be willing to say that, A, love is my teacher. You have to actually be a student in some deep way and surrender to the master, one, Eli, what you said so beautifully, and two, you have to be willing to really receive what Gangaji said, which is, you know, it was so useful, and then it wasn't useful anymore. You have to actually, you know, meet the Buddha on the road and kill him, meaning you have to really give up the certainty, right, the understanding that guided your life yesterday, and be willing to open up in moment-to-moment awareness to what's really present today, which requires enormous effort. Right? There's a huge, the post-conventional. This is what we would call in integral terms, right? We call this the post-conventional. You know, the post-conventional, you know, requires enormous effort, and Eli, as you and I have talked in the past, you know, the paradox of it is that only if you're in the post-conventional, if you're actually there on the inside, right, does it make sense, and you try and translate it into the terms of the conventional, it seems like it's pre-conventional, right? In other words, so it's this real, you know, it's this real Leela, this real dance. I think Leela is just a wonderful word for it. So thank you for all of that, and let me move to two more questions, and then we're going to take questions from the people listening. We have many, many, many of them, right, that have come in, right? And the first question of the last two that I want to ask is you're a couple that works together and separately, right? Eli, you have, I mentioned it when we first began, a gentleman who had studied your work on the Enneagram from fixation to freedom, and had really been just gotten such beautiful benefits from it. And you've actually had an Enneagram school for quite a few years, which is, you know, which has just given so many gifts to so many people. And you're a teacher of awakening, right? I read, you know, your book, which is your kind of classical book that you actually gave me in a bookstore in Ashland, I believe. It's filled with my little notes on it. You and I actually once did a dialogue on it. We have to do more. And so from that context, here you are, you know, teaching Gangaji. You're teaching in the world in all the ways that you teach in you know, in Europe, in America, a teacher of awakening. How does it work? Right? How does it work as a couple? I mean, isn't that, I mean, just between you and me, you know, let's pretend no one's listening for a second. And that's hard to work together, right? I mean, you both fill up the space easily by yourselves. And all of a sudden, you're working with someone, yeah. Like, you know, I mean, like, what's going on in the back room that you can share with us? That's not easy.
Sometimes it's not easy. But often it's, you know, it's like playing music together or dancing together. I mean, when it's really good for us, it's like that. We are making love because we're in this tantric relationship. And I don't mean with us, I mean with the people who come with us, because we're learning from them, receiving from them at least as much as we're offering them. And all we have to offer is really based in our experience, whether it's an experience of profound realization or whether it's the experience of how do you get through a day. And so when that's happening, it's beautiful. And there are moments when it doesn't happen so well and there's awkwardness and I think he's talking too much and I'd like to talk or I wouldn't say it the way he's saying it. But that's just life. I'd say we both love teaching together and we really love teaching separately and find both of them supportive to us. Speaking for myself, as to us as a couple and to us as teachers, individual teachers.
Thank you, Gangaji. Eli?
Yeah, I would think what Gangaji said about improvisation is really it. It's like we're a jazz group, and we're two, and the audience is part of it. And so we kind of set the tone, and we play off each other, and we have riffs off each other, and then people come up and participate, and it becomes a group improvisation. And so in that, it's something beautiful. And yeah, it's really amazing. We're both, you know, type A or alpha, whatever it is, and we both can take up the space and both enjoy being on the stage alone and both very comfortable with it. And it's beautiful and fantastic to be able to share sentences and share thoughts and to be able to take a tangent off of one another's thoughts and bring it into flower in a completely new and fresh direction. And then sometimes the other one doesn't appreciate that direction and wouldn't have gone there, and you know. And we have that going on too, but it doesn't matter. That's secondary. You know? That's just opinions, and opinions really don't have any weight.
That's so great. You know, it's so great in a kind of really deep sense. You know, I do some deep joint teaching both with a Zen teacher, Dan Mushel Hamilton, who's my partner and I evolve, and my second partner and I evolve is Sally Kempton, you know, Durgananda. And you know, what we've found is that sometimes it can be really painful, you know, because when you're really on the inside, and I don't need to tell both of you this because you know it and live it, you know, an example and a model in the world, but when you're on the inside and teaching, it's so obviously grace. It's so obviously not you. I mean, the non-dual is so obviously alive. And then you're like in the middle of it, and you know exactly where you want to go, not because you want to go, because you're just out of the way. Then all of a sudden, the other person goes in a completely different direction. You're saying, "Oh my God!" And it's like and there's actually like it's almost like a painful jolt, like into like your inside experience. It's like, "Oh my God!" And I mean, I have a couple of words to describe it, which I can't say on the air. to really get through that. You know, to really get through that is by itself that you've both lived through that and clearly experienced. And I want to say this to everyone listening. You know, Eli and Gangaji now, and here I'm going to be presumptuous, you know, with your permission, you know, are actually being very, very, very modest. But actually, it's enormously, enormously huge feat to be able to teach together. You know, the Beatles couldn't work it out. You know, the Rolling Stones did. You know, right? You know, and to be able to work it out by itself requires such an evolution beyond ego, right? That you just have to be, you're working it out in every teaching, and that you both beautiful teachers have done that is in itself this huge, colossal teaching. Mm. You know, so I really want to just to hold that.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad. I'm so happy because we benefit from it. And, if you're benefiting, that benefit spreads to all, especially if you happen to be up on the stage.
One thing that I really would like to acknowledge Gangaji for in all this is that, you know, after my affair turned into a scandal and a nightmare and I was basically down and out, Gangaji's willingness to stand there with me and to teach with me is really, I mean, it affected her. I mean, people put her down for it, and she lost credibility for standing with me. But her deep, deep integrity and her deep, deep love and her willingness to put herself on the line and to teach with me when the whole world hated me is really just something that really nobody really acknowledges enough, and I would need to say it here publicly. So thank you.
Thank you, Eli. It just blows me out of the water, you know. And there's nothing deep or smart I can say to that other than to bow and to acknowledge in brotherhood that when I went through, and I think many people on the call know, I went through a great, great tragedy in my life. I can't believe it's four and a half years ago. And when you know Dan Hamilton, you know, the first year, and Sally Kempton the second year, really stood by me. You know, in 2 years where those are the years that we met in, actually. In 2 years when it was completely unclear, right, what was going to happen, and they really stood in integrity, you know, there's a gift of the divine feminine, you know, in that kind of moment, which you know, one can only bow and acknowledge with huge delight. And so I thank you, Eli, for bringing that space, you know, here. And just what a delight to talk to you both. And what I need to do now is actually stop talking and really acknowledge everyone on the call, right, who's listening. There's hundreds and hundreds of people on the call right now. We just got I always get in the middle of the call, what's going on? And there's so many questions. So what I'm going to do now, Eli and Gangaji, with your permission, is I'm just going to run through and I'm just going to ask you questions. Some of them might reflect things we've talked about already, but, you know, in a different voice. And let's see what we can do. We only have a half hour, so it's a short time. And I appreciate you guys really, really being here in the middle of the jet lag and being with us. So let me just ask some questions coming in. So first we have Josh in Ann Arbor. Okay, Josh in Ann Arbor. Thank you, Josh. So Josh asks, what's the difference between love and wisdom? Is wisdom a kind of discarding where love could be an inquiry into all things, right? What's the difference between love and wisdom? Okay, there you have it.
I would say that wisdom is a facet of love, and that wisdom has a deep clarity and a deep clear seeing that comes through experience, and that this is wisdom is an expression of love, I would say.
Yeah, I would say it could be the ruthless expression of love, because it's independent of particular emotion or feeling. We often think of love in such a limited sentimental way and reference it to particular love feelings, which are beautiful, of course, but wisdom is actually free of that. It's love that's free of sentiment or feeling.
Yeah, love free of sentimentality.
Thank you. Josh, right, there you have it. Right, thank you very, very, very much. Right, Carolyn in St. George, Utah. Carolyn in St. George, Utah. We're in St. George, Utah. How do you find, this is a question right to you, Reb Eli, how do you find that the Enneagram information and teaching that you taught for so long fits into or serves your present teaching? Is that a fair question, Eli?
Sure. I would say that, first of all, probably what you're calling the Enneagram is nothing to do with what I teach, that 90% of 90% of what people call the Enneagram is called the Enneagram of Personality. And that's not what I teach. I teach the Enneagram of Liberation, which shows deep character structure and deep ego structure. It shows us our character flaws, and it shows us our deep possibility for awakening. So we use the Enneagram together as a couple, and it really, really served us and prepared us for meeting our teacher. And it shows you the difference between fixation and essence. And it makes it very, very clear, and it shows the traps of the egoic mind in such a clear and beautiful way that you can't mistake it. You can't say, oh, well, I thought it was something else. And in that way, the Enneagram is a great wisdom mirror. It serves for both awakening and for stability in your realization by showing you the difference between who you are and who you are not. So the Enneagram starts out with the basic misidentification of who we believe we are. We believe we are a body. We believe we are this emotion. We believe we are these thoughts. These are my thoughts, my feelings, my body. But the Enneagram shows you the structure of this my that believes it is a body, that believes it is a thought, that believes it is an emotion. And in showing you that, you have a clear distinction between the real and the unreal. And that's one of the basis for discovering enlightenment or realization, is you have to know the difference between what's real and what's not real.
Beautiful. So, Eli, the Enneagram, and I think I heard the sentence from you originally, so I don't want to quote you back a sentence from you without quoting it, but I believe when we were down in that treatment, you know, and you should have so many healthy, beautiful, beautiful years, and the blessing of this teaching should just invest you with such health for so many years, right? I think you said to me that the Enneagram tells you who you're not.
That's right. The Enneagram is an exquisite description of who you're not. In the most subtle ways, physically,
right,
emotionally,
right,
and mentally.
Right, right. And I would add, I remember we had this discussion, we're not going to play it out for people again here, you know, it tells you who you're not only, as you both said beautifully about non-duality, and you're that, but you're so much more than that, right, you know, in that non-dual sense. So thank you so much. And Carolyn, I hope this was very, very helpful to you. And I want to just say, I just got a question coming in. You know, when Eli described about our descriptions of teaching, you know, and partner teaching, you know, to say that, you know, I talked about the pain of teaching, you know, together and how that's sometimes difficult, but I want to just emphasize, because I just got two questions on it from different people, you know, what an incredible delight it is. I mean, you can feel the delight of Eli and Gangaji teaching together. I have incredible delight in teaching with Diane, incredible delight when I teach with Sally, and there's this deep feeling that the sum total of what we offer together, right, is ultimately larger than what would be offered separately. And that's where the gift is, and that's where the serving of truth is, right, that Eli talked about earlier. That the ultimate decision comes from the fact that there's a deeper service, there's a deeper truth, and a deeper delight in the ultimate sense, in the ultimate calculus. I wanted to clarify that, and thank you people who wrote it on that. Gangaji, this is a question for you coming in from Anna in Galanta, or Galanta, Anna. I apologize if I've mispronounced. Right, Gangaji, could you say something about finding a spiritual and material freedom in this dangerous world where so many things have to be considered in order to just be safe.
First of all, you can't be safe. The body is not safe, internally or externally. Of course, there are things you can do that lead to more probable safety, and all of us on this call are privileged that we have access to good food, protection, that we aren't dodging bombs, and we are a very privileged group, and yet we aren't ultimately safe. Each of us will die, and we don't know how or when. And many of us will suffer from disease or whatever. So if we're looking for safety, it's a futile search. I would say the only safety, the ultimate safety, is really surrendering to the fact that there is no final safety. And in that surrender, then, there is an expansion of what is fulfilled, to continue the use of a word we started earlier, what is complete in itself, even in the face of death, even in the face of danger from all directions, physical danger, emotional danger, mental danger. But the search for safety, I mean, that's the search that has, you know, it leads to extreme materialism, it leads to extreme protection, and still there's no safety. It doesn't work. So I just couldn't support anyone in that, in the search for safety. But in taking the question seriously, I would say, if you consider safety, and if you consider that if somehow you were able to find ultimate safety, what would that give you? What would you have then? Because that, if you can answer that question, then we can get at what the desire for safety is actually fueled by. And I would say for many people it's peace, or it's rest, or it's a willing capacity to stop. So if you can look under the issue of searching for safety, actually stop the search, and in this moment be completely unsafe, then you can actually discover what's here regardless of safety or danger.
Thank you. Thank you, Gangaji. And I feel Anna's thank you coming through. And just these, each one of these questions, of course, is a world, and be able to answer it in several short sentences is unfair, but I think you really just captured something so essential. You know, Anna, thank you. And each one of these questions is really a voice in the room. So, Eli, right, and people, for whatever reason, some people are addressing questions to both of you, and some are addressing to individuals, so I'm kind of following that as it comes through. Right, this is from Sigari Luckwell in Bunbury, Western Australia. So Sigari says, right, on Full Circle, which is a radio program in Western Australia, this Sunday he says that, I don't know if Sigari is a man or a woman, so Sigari, I apologize. I'll address you in a transgender way. Right, this Sunday at 4 p.m., you're going to be exploring a show which is called Love Has Its Own Strengths. And so you're asking how to be strong as a female and also loving, right? Question one. Right? How to be, wow, that's so interesting. Right? When does being strong, right, really mean being strong? When is love really love? And when does it become a sham, become a lack of responsibility for our own actions? How to know when the action is avoidance of feeling? I sometimes feel I'm, now we know the answer. I sometimes feel I'm too male as a woman. So Sigari is a woman. I sometimes feel I'm too male as a woman. Any comment you could make would be very welcome. So, Eli, I know there's a lot there, and you'll have to pick up whichever one
interests
you. But please, thank you.
So I would say that Gangaji is the strongest person I've ever met. And her strength comes from her integrity and love. It doesn't come from her will to dominate. And that's the difference. So that there's a strength that comes from will to dominate, which is the animal wanting to be on top. And there's a strength that comes from the integrity of being true to love that is absolutely the strongest force I've ever met. And so Gangaji is the strongest woman I've ever met. And if you would look at her or you would see her, you would not call her a strong woman because she doesn't appear that way. But her strength is in her integrity. And then there's, as I said, the distinction between the strength of integrity in love and the animal force that wants to be on top, wants to be right, wants to dominate. And in that, that's a false strength that really has nothing to do with love. It has to do with being an animal and being a dominant animal. And so in that, you know, you know that's where the taming of the animal in service of love becomes something that's useful and something that the relationship really serves, if it's a relationship of love.
That's fantastic. Sigari, you have it there. Take it to Western Australia. Okay, thank you very, very, very much. Fantastic. I just have to say one thing, Eli, which I'm allowed to say, but, you know, don't. I'll have to ask your permission after I say it. You said when you look at Gangaji, you say, oh, my God, she's beautiful. Right? That's when I first met I met her, I said, Gangaji, you're totally beautiful. Oh, my God. And isn't it great to be able to say to someone they're beautiful? I mean, oh, my God, what a delightful thing to say. So wow, that's so great.
Yeah.
And let's all tell, you know, let's just all reflect beauty back to each other. We're so afraid, right, to actually say those things these days because everything goes through so many prisms of interpretation. You know, so wow, just to say to someone, wow, you're beautiful, right, to say to a teacher, a friend, so what a delight. So, Gangaji, the next question is coming to you. I hope I didn't embarrass you.
Not at all. It's another way of saying I love you.
Absolutely. Completely.
I tell Gangaji how beautiful she is many times a day.
Amen. Amen. And Eli, you're totally beautiful. Right?
That's
You're both totally beautiful. That is absolutely, completely, delightfully right. Colette from Phoenix, Arizona. Colette, how are you? Colette writes as follows. She writes, my karmic patterns are taking up space in my thoughts, my emotions, and physically a lot of pain and discomfort as they're brought up in my consciousness. My whole body and mind are feeling overwhelmed, and I'm spending as much time in the silence as I can, yet I still have to work. I'm not sure how to be with this. I'm open to your wisdom. Thank you for your love. Can you offer me some guidance, Gangaji?
Well, I can first of all empathize with the state you find yourself in. It's the human state, and maybe when we actually begin searching for deeper wisdom, we are confronted with deeper aggravation along the way, because we aren't able to deny what we were able to deny previously. I'll just pick out one phrase that you mentioned about staying in the silence, and I know as a teacher who invites people into silence that I'm partly responsible for this, but the silence is not something that's separate from who you are. And when I'm really doing my job perfectly, there is a recognition that when you allow yourself, you discover that no matter what else is going on mentally, physically, emotionally, karmically, circumstantially, in the core there is silence. And that's who you are. Silent awareness is who you are. And when we are willing to discover that, rather than to get to that, it may sound like a petty distinction, but it's actually huge. We are willing to stop trying to get anywhere and simply discover this vast silent awareness. It is a self-discovery. And then we notice that on the periphery or on the surface of this discovery, there can be discomforts, or there can be bliss, there can be wonderful moods or horrible moods, physical discomforts, whatever. But in the depths, there we are in our purity, in our serenity, in our silence. So it's not about you getting to silence. It's really you recognizing what is already silent. Whatever else is going on, in the core, you are, and you are silent awareness.
I mean, thank you, Gangaji. And to really, Colette, you know, because your question, there's about four or five other questions that mirror yours that we won't get to, but just so that everyone can really kind of feel that, not as a spiritual bypass, because I've actually heard critiques, right, you know, along the way of kind of like, well, when, you know, this kind of beautiful depth answer that Gangaji gave, right, you know, is this a spiritual bypass? So the answer is no, right? You've actually heard Eli and Gangaji talk in great depth about the depth of their relationship, about how they've really worked through on all levels, that non-duality includes, right, all the complexity of incarnation, and that you need to deploy all of the tools
So when Gangaji talks and you feel in her voice the deep silence, she's not expressing it in the form of what's been termed spiritual bypass. It's not that kind of, it's actually in full awareness and incarnation and embodiment of all the complexities, working and deploying all of the tools of the ground of it all, right, is that deep silence. So thank you so much. Thank you so much, Gangaji, Colette, and everyone else, the five or six other people who asked a similar question. Thank you so much. Eli, this is a question for you, and we only have about 10 minutes left. So thank you, everyone, for your questions. We're going to get to as many as we can in this time. And Eli and Gangaji, I know that you're exhausted, having just flown in from Europe, so thank you for your patience and for staying with us.
This is great medicine, Mark.
This is completely delightful. So Eli, here's the question, right? Someone writes in, I just had an interchange with someone I'm very close to, right, who works with me in my organization, right? She gave me feedback on a particular issue. I responded in a way that I thought was honoring and loving. She didn't receive it in that way, right? What do we do when, with people that we love so much, in the exchange, somehow our intent and the impact on the person isn't the same? How do we work with that?
The greatest challenge is not to take anything personally. If you don't take it personally, there's an open space for something deeper to be discovered. And if one person is taking it personally and one person isn't, well, what, there's nothing to be done, really. I mean, you just be the space for that to play itself out. But really the challenge is when we take it personally, we then want something from the other, and we're trying to get them to do what we want or to understand it the way we want them to understand it. Or we feel hurt when they don't get, they don't receive us the way we want to be received. And that's where the testing is for us, so that in that feedback we get, when we feel hurt and misunderstood, that's where it shows us where we're taking it personally and clinging to something. In the possibility of not clinging and being open, then there's an unknown space that it can develop or not, as it does. And then it's really no one in control, because the tendency is just to want to be in control and do it differently. But then it's ego versus ego. But if it's not personal, if it's open, then there's a possibility for the unwinding to happen in a space of non-confrontation. I guess that's what I would say.
That's fantastic, yeah. I mean, that's fantastic. And to everyone, you know, to every one of us who've been in that situation where, you know, intent and impact kind of get conflated, and there's like this little moment, not even the big moments, little moments, just to kind of take Eli's teaching in and to actually feel, to love into the openness, to love open through the moment of pain. Thank you so, so much, Eli. And I want to say, you know, out of that thank you, right, thank you for some feedback I just got, which is, right, hey, right, please make sure to open up the lines. Right, there's so many questions coming in on the webcast, so we're let me just open up the lines for a second. The way to open up the line is to press *7. Melanie, you just wrote in from Denver, right, and said, please, I want to ask a question on the line. I have very Amish internet access. Prefer to use the telephone. So
Mark.
Yes.
That's like driving in a covered wagon from New York to California.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Thanks for taking my call. And, boy, that last answer really helped a lot for what I was leading up to. Eli, when you said the horror of the lie, how I'm experiencing, and I'm wondering if this is what you meant, it's the horror of the lie is forgetting what I am when I'm in fear. And that's, I've had an incredible experience recently of realizing how I identified like it was who I am with all of the false self stuff. And it was a very sobering moment that first time. And so I'm playing with, well, how do I sustain remembering that I am the divine essence? And there was this incredible repugnance, and I'm wondering if that's what you meant, the horror of the lie, when I forget what I truly am.
I say that if you forget what you truly are, then it's a concept, and it's best to forget it.
Oh.
But when you realize
but it's
who
a
you
being,
are,
yeah.
And when you realize who you are, you can't forget it, just like your name now.
God.
It's like, could you wake up in the morning and forget my name. It's like, that's a more superficial level of knowing. That's just something that's been programmed in, but mm-hmm. you can't forget it. It's been so deep. But what I'm speaking about is when you realize yourself so deeply, you can't forget it because it's just who you are.
How can I get there?
That's very good. And the way you get there is by telling the truth about who you've identified yourself as being and who you are not.
It's so ugly. It's just so ugly.
Yes. And so the possibility is to, even in saying it's ugly, you're still taking it personally about the pain of it. So when there's a clear-mindedness of, is this who I am? Now, are you this body? Are you the body? Are you this body? Are you these thoughts? Are you these feelings? Examine it very closely for yourself without belief, without concept, without any idea of what the answer is. And then you'll go deeper and you'll find at the bottom, you'll find the truth of yourself. And when you find the truth of yourself, you fall in love and you give yourself. And when you fall in love, you don't forget your partner. When you fall in love, you don't have to remember your partner. You're in love.
Wow.
And so when you're in love, you give yourself more deeply, and you give yourself so deeply that you are then absorbed back into yourself. And when you're absorbed back into yourself, you can't forget yourself. You just are yourself. And then you just are as you are.
Oh,
and then
wow.
things come up, things happen, and, you know, circumstances will come to test you, and everything will come as a test of love, and it will either further deepen you into yourself, or it will pull you back out with some identification so you can see more clearly, that's, I get that, I'm not going to do that one again. You fall back in deeper.
Wow, thank you.
So good to hear you, yes, beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila. Thank you. Thank you very much. And let's open up the lines. Thank you, Sheila. *7. We still have many, many, many webcast questions. So if you want to jump in on the line, please do so now. *7.
Hello. Am I on the line?
You are.
Oh, wow. I am so afraid to ask this question that my solar plexus chakra just did a huge spin. But
Tell us your name. Tell us your name, dear one.
Oh, it's Susan.
Hi, Susan.
Susan. I have to take a deep breath and let this question come up into the voice chakra, because it really is addressed. It's addressed to both Eli and Gangaji, and because you're both committed to truth, I feel the courage and the trust to ask. And it's very intimate, so I hope you'll be able to indulge. And that's what, it's really hard for me to ask this, but what was it, Eli, for you, that made you or makes you vulnerable to other women? And I'm speaking as a woman because I have been a woman who attracts and is vulnerable to men who aren't available, in that they're married, but obviously they are available. They're not that married. And when I say they're not that married, I'm sure you realize that there are depths of marriage. It just keeps going deeper and deeper into the question of what it is. And then it's that Leela that you talk about. So if you could go down to that depth, that you may already have done this, to what is it that makes you vulnerable to women like I
women like you.
Even, yeah, and I honestly, I have to say, thank you. And
that was hilarious.
Thank you. This is gorgeous. Thank you. But I have to say, I have to say that I deliberately tried not to be that kind of a woman. I tried not to be that kind of a little girl or an adolescent, and yet it happened.
Susan, that's great. My responsibility as host here,
yeah.
which is, you know, I've kind of invited, let me just step in. So thank you for the question, because we don't have a lot of time, so I want to kind of hold for a second. I want to put a wedge of awareness in for a second, then turn to Eli, which is, Susan, appreciate the question, right? And Rev Eli can, with grace and delight, decide to engage it or decide that this is not the form that he wants to engage it in. And I want to kind of say that very clearly just from my own personal experience, right, that one of the things that happens in the public forum, right, is that people ask any question, and sometimes this would be the right form to engage it, and other times it completely wouldn't be, and that Eli can, with delight and freedom, choose what path he wants, and we'll completely honor it, because we're really about really honoring Eli and his beautiful teaching here. So please, Eli.
Oh, that's so sweet. Thank you, Mark. And the truth is that I'm fine with answering it, and I didn't think I was vulnerable, quite honestly. I was happily celibate for 10 years after meeting my teacher and did not see myself as vulnerable and was very happy in my celibacy. I just finished with sex. I was finished with that whole scene and going about my merry way. And then, I walked out of a book signing, and there was a woman on the street who, and I fell in love. And my vulnerability is that I take care of. And that's one of the traps I've seen in my character, is that my tendency is to want to take care of the other and give them what they want. And when I fall in love and get into that, I become a bimbo, I have to say. And that's it's one of my character flaws. And I've been happy to see it.
Thank you. Rabbi, thank you for the answer. And Susan, thank you for the question and for the grace of the exchange. We're now at the end of our time.
I'll do that.
Thank you very, very much, Susan. Thank you, Rabbi Eli. We're now at the end of our time. And I really want to thank everyone for being with us, to really invite everyone, before I do a formal thank you, to invite everyone to be with us, right? Wow. To be with us at Integral Spiritual Experience. Integral Spiritual Experience, which we actually invited Gangaji and Eli to come to this year, but initially... No. We're now closing our call, whoever's ever on the line, so we're going to have to get you your question on the next time. So I'm going to ask you to gently just kind of hang up so we can actually have a free line. Thank you so much. Right. Before I thank Eli and Gangaji, I want to invite everyone to the Integral Spiritual Experience. Although you were going to be originally in Australia when I invited you, when we all invited you both this coming year, we hope in future years you'll be with us. The Integral Spiritual Experience will be right on the topic of the future of love. Many of the issues that we talked about today will be engaging. It will be over the New Year's weekend at Asilomar, right, in Monterey, this coming New Year's. There are now already hundreds of people signed up. There's room for about, I don't know the exact number, but not that many more people. I'm going to gently ask anyone who's on the line that shouldn't be, we occasionally have this problem, to please hang up your phone, press *6 and disconnect so we can get a clear phone line. Thank you, thank you, thank you. So we're looking forward to see everyone, right, on the Future of Love gorgeous seminar experience at the end of December. And Eli and Gangaji, we look forward in future years. I know you couldn't make it this year, to your being with us. And most of all, I want to say now, right, a huge thank you to everyone on the call, and a huger than huge thank you, right, to Reb Eli, to Reb Gangaji, for the grace, the depth, the presence, the stillness, and the shakti, right, of your answers, of your presence, of your being with us. Thank you both so very much.
Oh, Mark, thank you. What a gift.
Thank you, Reb Mordecai. We love you, love you, love you.
Yeah, love you back. Thank you, everybody. Reb Gangaji, Reb Eli, please look at their websites to really be with them in satsang and their teachings. You can look under Gangaji, under the Leela Foundation, that they've got so many great teachings. And from an integral perspective, right, everything comes up in all four quadrants. Everything happens at different levels of consciousness. You'll experience the teaching based on your level of consciousness. Right? Enjoy, everyone. We'll see you at the Integral Spiritual Experience. Good Shabbos. It's Sabbath, everyone. Good Shabbos. Thank you, everybody. Shalom. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The moderator has left the conference.